fourth case of the morning, which is Johnson versus Dorsey, appeal number 06-2950. Mr. Fleming.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Michael Fleming. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Mary Johnson. This case comes to you as a result of the district court, Judge Norgel, denying the plaintiff's motion for leave to file a first amended complaint and ultimately dismissing her previously filed complaint. The judge's basis for his ruling was that any amendment would be futile in defeating an affirmative defense of statute of limitations or that there was probable cause which would deny plaintiff any opportunity to pursue any of her claims which she stated in her complaint. The plaintiff's complaint is grounded for federal jurisdiction purposes on a 1983 action of a violation of her constitutional rights. She alleged that her constitutional rights were violated under the 4th, the 5th, and the 14th Amendment, and her allegation is pursuant to Section 1983 that she's seeking relief for denial, specifically for a denial of her due process of law, for her right to a fair trial, and for Brady violation, which is the basis for her not receiving a fair trial.
Now, you didn't actually, in this situation, need leave of court to file an amended complaint. That's because of the procedural posture of the case. There had been no responsive pleadings filed by the defendants. There was a motion to dismiss, which is not the equivalent. Did you point that out to the district court?
We did not. What happened in the Judge Norgel had 2-minute orders where he was not addressing the defendant's motions to dismiss, but directly was challenging me to overcome those hurdles. In response to that, I was dealing directly with the judge, and I felt it most appropriate to file a motion seeking leave and informing him of how we would do that. Upon review of the rule, there had been no responsive pleadings, and we should have been able to file it as a matter of course. The district court never looked at that particular aspect of it in dismissing her complaint or denying the motion. The first time we raised it, though, was on appeal. And we did spend a little bit of time saying that as a matter of course, it has to be granted. It's not even within the discretion of the court to deny it.
Had you at that point filed a response to the motion to dismiss, or did this exchange preempt that?
This exchange preempted that. The defendants had filed their motions in late April or early May. We were in court the first or second week in May where the court said, irrespective of the motions, here's where your problem is, directly at me. We went back to court within a few weeks, and I filed a motion seeking leave to amend. The court granted that. Or said, you can have 21 days, file a proposed amended complaint, though, so I can see where you're going. And he specifically said, in regards to the Wallace issue that you have, and in regards to the fact that the colloquy was, the judge said, we can't find this on appeal anywhere. And I said, it never got to that point. It was a motion for new trial. He said, was there ever a finding of probable cause? I said, yes, there was. There was a grand jury indictment. And that's the way it was left with the court. And when we did our proposed amended complaint, even though we didn't have to at that point because it's an affirmative defense, because the judge raised it, we extensively alleged both regarding the statute of limitations, why we felt that we were completely within the statute, and even if we weren't, that there was an equitable tolling or that the statute had been suspended due to fraudulent concealment. But we also alleged, and I believe we did it in the first complaint, where there was no probable cause.
Well, and as I understand it, the case procedurally, there was no response from the defendants to your proposed amended complaint.
But, correct. We filed it on June 9th of 2006. The court dismissed it on June 16th of 2006. There had been no written response, no written objection.
So there wasn't ever any joining of issue on the fraudulent concealment or the equitable tolling as it pertains to the statute of limitations basis on which the complaint was dismissed.
Correct.
It's a little unorthodox.
It was. We appeared in court twice, and the court directed their comments to me exclusively regarding the validity of the complaint.
And the court never, in the sua sponte dismissal, took up the due process Brady claims?
They did not. He did not.
It was solely on the Wallace Fourth Amendment statute of limitations issue?
Correct. It parroted Wallace, saying, it basically said, your statute starts the day you're arrested, and your 2 years was up 2 years ago. And we didn't allege a Fourth Amendment false imprisonment, false arrest claim. Our complaint alleged against each and every defendant under 1983 that she did not receive a fair trial, that there was a Brady violation, and that she would not receive due process of law. And we supplemented that, even beyond the notice pleadings that's required, we supplemented that with extensive facts that we alleged to support that conclusion. It was not, and it was not addressed by the court, and that's why in the court's ruling, I wanted to give a short recitation of the facts because the court didn't analyze our proposed amended complaint in reaching its conclusion. It simply said you're out of the box on the statute based upon what the court perceived as a Wallace issue and also in regards to the probable cause, which it either misperceived what we were alleging or didn't regard it at all. But what happened in this case was the plaintiff lived in a townhome, rented a townhome in Hanover Park. There was a fire at her home on March 26th. Hanover Park responded, and also the DuPage County Arson Task Force responded, and they have a team that goes out. They're on call 24 hours, 7 days a week. They responded also with a team of at least eight individuals. They were there the entire day. They secured the scene. Their purpose is to collect forensic evidence, to take photographs, and to observe the scene and determine if there's a cause and origin for the fire whether or not there's any accelerants that could have been used in the fire. And in this case, they did that. They went to the scene. They prepared a report. And we alleged in our complaint that report was memorialized and given to these defendants within a week of the fire. We also alleged that
the report says no arson.
It says that the cause and origin is undetermined and that there were no accelerants used.
Okay.
And the sole purpose of that arson task force, they're all people that have been picked to be on this to determine if there's a fire. They're sent out to determine if a crime has been committed.
But that report doesn't get disclosed until after she's charged, tried, and convicted.
Correct.
Sentenced the first time, and then there's a motion for a new trial.
That's correct.
And that's when it comes out.
That's correct. And it was discovered not through any of the defendants volunteering that they had it. It was discovered independent of the prosecution, independent of law enforcement. And I think it's important to note that the prosecutor that tried the case both the first time and the second time, the prosecutor that indicted the case was, we allege, he was present for a meeting within a week of the fire with the co-defendants, had knowledge of this report, and then buried that report in the process of prosecuting the plaintiff in this case. Once that report became known to the defendant, she was granted a new trial and then prevailed at her new trial within 5 months. Upon revealing that report, that report basically undermined everything that happened with the subsequent investigation by Allstate Insurance Company. And that's, we allege, that's why it was withheld. It ruined their case. The case against Mary Johnson was a completely circumstantial case. And the report that the trained law enforcement people, which included ATF, the State Fire Marshal's Office, local law enforcement, and local fire departments, the ATF agent actually wrote the report that said, we can't determine a cause and origin here. We can't, and affirmatively said there was no accelerant used. Allstate Insurance Company, within a month, had a report saying that there was an accelerant used. And that's the basis for them denying her insurance claim. And what was found out as a result of knowing that there was exculpatory evidence, which basically exonerated this plaintiff, we found out that Allstate, in fact, paid for the experts at the first trial, which was unknown to the defendant at the first trial. Allstate essentially sponsored that first trial. And we've alleged that the criminal investigation was dormant from approximately April 5th when this meeting took place And Allstate's investigation was essentially done in April. They ultimately denied her insurance claim in June. Nothing happened of any consequence until on August 7th. She hired a lawyer who sent a letter to Allstate saying that she was disputing the denial of her claim and she wanted to seek legal redress if she wasn't given her claim. And that her arrest occurred within several days after that disclosure, after the attorney contacted Allstate. And nothing new had occurred. And that's where we allege the conspiracy occurred between these defendants.
Better save a little time. You got in your rebuttal time.
I'll then, if there's no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. O'Connor.
Morning, Your Honors. I'm going to take 10 minutes on behalf of the DuPage County State's Attorney and Hanover Park, et cetera. And Mr. Broderick, counsel for Allstate, will take the other 5 minutes, if I may. The plaintiff is right. What he had said is that the sole basis for federal jurisdiction in this case is the alleged 1983. All of the other claims that he made in both the original and the amended complaint were brought pursuant to state law, and that was the false arrests, false imprisonment, malicious prosecution, and conspiracy were all brought pursuant to state law. The only federal claim that he alleged in either the original complaint or his proposed amended complaint and against all defendants was the Brady violation. And
right, there's some procedural irregularities in this case, but putting that aside for a minute, if there is a Brady violation, a failure to disclose exculpatory evidence, that cause of action accrues under Heck versus Humphrey when the conviction is set aside. So how can there be a statute of limitations problem in this case?
Well, and I agree that the only statute of limitations problem he would have had is if he had the false arrest and imprisonment claims brought pursuant to the Fourth Amendment. The Brady violation, is at least our argument in our brief, is not a timeliness issue, but rather the fact that the plaintiff could not establish, even taking his allegations in the proposed amended complaint as true, he couldn't establish a Brady violation because his complaint, both the original and the amended complaint, assert that in addition to this task force report being disseminated to all of the defendants, it was disseminated to the DuPage County State's Attorney. And that allegation, the complaint, would exonerate all defendants other than the prosecutor, which we feel would have a separate immunity for his failure to turn over exculpatory evidence to the extent to which he had it to the defense in the criminal prosecution.
How would it exonerate them if there was a conspiracy to withhold this? And that's what the complaint alleges, as I understand it.
But the conspiracy is a state law conspiracy claim. I mean, he's pled...
I thought it's a federal civil rights conspiracy.
Well, he pled conspiracy under both the original complaint and the...
I'm not talking about conspiracy as a cause of action. I'm talking about the 1983 claim here is that the defendants all conspired, all state and all of the state actors conspired with each other to suppress this report, which is a Brady violation. And that's the heart of the federal civil rights claim in this case. And it was dismissed sua sponte by the district court on statute of limitations grounds that pertain to a false arrest claim. And that is unorthodox or irregular, the words that are being used from the bench this morning. And the court didn't address the arguments or the claims that are being made in this case.
The court did not in its order address the Brady violation claim.
Right, so we're not going to get to that in the first instance on appeal. The plaintiff was entitled to file an amended complaint. As of right, there was no responsive pleading filed, and she should not have been denied that right. And all of these substantive arguments are for later, not to be raised for the first time on appeal.
Well, I understand. I'm not the appellant. I mean, I am just responding to
But you're asking us to you're asking us to sustain the dismissal on all kinds of substantive grounds that were never addressed by the district court because the case was dismissed on a statute of limitations basis that is inapplicable here.
But this court can affirm the lower court's decision on any basis that appears in the record.
Right, but she is you would admit that she is entitled to file an amended complaint in the procedural posture that this case was in under the rules of civil procedure because no responsive pleading had yet been filed. So the plaintiff has a right to file without leave of court an amended complaint in this situation, and she was denied that right.
Right.
You don't get into issues of futility and all the rest of it unless there's leave of court that's required, which was not in this situation.
Right. And my time is up. I concede to the Allstate's attorney
to answer your question.
Well, you're not going to get away that easily.
Don't try and run away.
I agree that they had a right to file an amended complaint. And all we are saying is that even accepting, and we argued in our brief, we argued as if they did file that second amended complaint or the first amended complaint. And what we said is that she cannot establish a Brady violations for the reasons we set forth there. So even if they were allowed, or even if they did file that amended complaint, it would have been a futile exercise because they could not establish a Brady violation, which is the sole federal jurisdiction pled. They couldn't have established a Brady violation in any event.
I have a question. We'll not take this off of Mr. Broderick's time. But what explanation was ever given for not disclosing a report, a fairly thorough investigation soon after the fire, that no accelerants were found and there was really no evidence of arson?
Yep.
Why was Johnson not told that?
I can only speak as I was the original attorney for Hanover Park only. I don't know why that it was not turned over to them during the course of the criminal trial. It wasn't, since we were dealing solely with a motion to dismiss, if they take what allegations they had is true.
You haven't read the trial record?
I have the trial record, but I don't have the...
Well, there was a motion for a new trial that the plaintiff prevailed upon.
Right.
So presumably it was established. As a factual matter.
Oh, it was established that they didn't have it. I mean, that the defense did not receive.
Yeah, and my question is simple. Why not? Why wouldn't that have been disclosed?
I can't answer.
A lot of times we get Brady arguments where, you know, it's arguably Brady or, it's kind of close. But, boy, this one doesn't even seem close at all. An investigation disclosing no accelerants were used and no evidence of arson. And it... close in time to the fire, right after the fire.
I mean, it was my recollection that it was inconclusive as to two of the samples and no accelerants on the other. But in any event, and so I'm not sure that it was a completely exonerating document. I mean, she was still retried following the disclosure of that anyway. I mean, she was acquitted in the second trial. But it's not as though the indictment was dismissed. So, but to answer your question briefly, I don't know why it wasn't disclosed.
I mean, there could be an explanation. We thought we disclosed it. We reviewed it and didn't think it was Brady material, so we didn't disclose it. Is there anything here that tells us why?
Not in the record before this court.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Broderick. We'll give you a full 5 minutes if you want.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is John Broderick. I'm here to offer arguments regarding the non-state actor defendants, Kevin McMahon, Allstate, John Rayburn, and Dropka and Rayburn. I agree with my colleague that the Court can affirm the decision of the District Court based on any grounds in the record. Although there might be a procedural irregularity, I think the District Court could take a look at this court can deem that the amended complaint was filed, and the lower court could still have sua sponte looked at the allegations and found they didn't cure the defects of the complaint and dismissed the complaint. Just with respect to the allegations regarding the non-state actors, It is the only allegation against them that holds them in federal court is the allegation that they conspired with the state actors to violate their constitutional rights. It's fundamental that if the underlying constitutional rights are not established, then the conspiracy claim fails, and then there would be no federal jurisdiction.
That's correct. Here there's a question about whether there was an underlying constitutional violation.
That's true. If, with respect to the...
if there is, then any private actor who conspires with the state actors within the web of people responsible under 1983?
To some extent, that wouldn't apply equally to all defendants here. For instance, the corporate defendants, Allstate and Dropka, are only being held in this case on federal jurisdiction based on the allegation that they were vicariously liable for their employees. That's counts 16 and 20. As I think, as the court knows, the doctrine of respondeat superior is not recognized in the area of Section 1983 litigation. And plaintiff's argument to the contrary, which he cites relies on the Woodward case, does not contradict that longstanding precedence.
Was the Brady violation substantiated in the criminal proceeding? I assumed that it was because the plaintiff was granted a new trial. So we have an established Brady violation, don't we?
We don't have an established Brady violation to the extent that the prosecutors were aware of the alleged exculpatory evidence. That's the Newsom doctrine. Under that doctrine, the violation, you get a private cause of, just because you have a Brady violation doesn't mean you have a private cause of action.
What was the new trial granted? On what basis? I assumed it was the Brady violation for the nondisclosure of this report. Is that not the case?
We can assume that. There is questions whether how exculpatory that report is, as my colleague pointed out.
Okay.
But even if there is a Brady violation, Your Honor, there still has to be, once the exculpatory information is turned over to the prosecutor, there's no private right of action against the police or the police defendants or the other state actors who may be involved. The Brady violation does not necessarily establish a private cause of action. You still have it. You don't get that private cause of action. Let me back up. You state a claim under Newsom if the state actors do not turn over the exculpatory evidence to the prosecutor. That's the cause of action. Once he alleged that the exculpatory evidence was known to the prosecutor, remember the report was distributed to everybody at a meeting, according to his allegation, I believe, including the prosecutor. There might have been a Brady violation, but then there's no Newsom claim.
Was it established in the criminal proceedings that Allstate paid the state's experts?
I'm not sure if that was established in a criminal proceeding. It wasn't alleged in the complaint. It was not alleged in the complaint.
Was it alleged in the amended complaint?
It was not alleged in the amended complaint.
Okay.
There's nothing about Allstate paying experts. The only allegation against Allstate is that they were vicariously liable for their agent McMahon, who, according to the amended complaint, only attended certain meetings. I won't prolong my discussion about respondeat superior. For those same reasons, we also feel that it is also our position that the defendants should be granted immunity under state law, the Illinois Property Fire Loss Act. Plaintiff makes an assertion that the insurance defendants, aren't entitled to immunity if they acted with malice, but plaintiff does not allege in his complaint specifically, nor does he point out in his reply brief that he actually alleged malice against these defendants. He alleges they engaged in a conspiracy, but under Illinois law, engaging in a conspiracy does not equate with malice. Furthermore, taking the act as a whole, the act requires the insurance defendants to cooperate with authorities in an arson investigation. The allegations in the complaint don't suggest that the defendants did anything other than attend meetings or interview plaintiff. Those acts do not give rise to the inference that we're acting with malice towards plaintiff or outside of our obligations under the Act. And plaintiff does not allege that Allstate developed unique information uniquely known to it that somehow it manipulated to cause her harm. Plaintiff only bases his allegations on this report that was known to everyone and tries to shoehorn in this Newsom violation against non-state actors, which he can't do under the federal law. I see my time is up. If the court has no questions, thank you.
Mr. Fleming, anything more?
Yeah. In regards to what we alleged in our proposed amended complaint, as a result of the discovery of the Arson Task Force report, additional subpoenas went out
And we did receive information that Allstate had, in fact, sponsored the first trial as far as paying the expert witnesses. We did allege that. It's in the appendix on page 88.
Is it your position that they had a right or a duty to inform the defendant of what that discovered, that is, the private defendants?
That they had a duty to disclose?
Mm-hmm. Writing material.
I think that they, as co-conspirators, had a duty to, once they agreed with the state actors, and we allege they acted under color of state law in prosecuting her.
The state actors are fairly obvious when you talk about a Brady violation. I'm modestly concerned about what duty and responsibility the private actors had in terms of holding Brady material.
I think when they step into the arena of prosecuting somebody criminally, and what we alleged was
private people do not prosecute people criminally. That's uniquely left to the state's attorney and the U.S. attorney.
It is, and our allegations, and it's a unique case because we allege that they actively promoted the criminal prosecution.
Well, they can promote it because the complainants can promote things, but they don't produce it. The problem of how to proceed with criminally is left to the prosecutor, state prosecutor.
I guess in response, they're under no affirmative obligation to disclose. I think in our case, they proceeded under the protection of knowing there was going to be a nondisclosure.
They didn't hide it from the prosecution. They didn't.
I believe inherent in what their agreement was early on that they did, because their experts carried the ball at the criminal trial and testified unfettered that there would be no comment about that arson task force. They would not be impeached, and it went unimpeached, and the judge found her guilty based upon what
that part of fun. My question, however, was limited to whether or not they had an affirmative obligation to disclose the information of the defendant. And you've answered my question, so we don't.
We did allege, in regards to vicarious liability, we didn't allege negligence as far as the actors that were agents of Allstate. We alleged that they intentionally, maliciously violated known constitutional rights of the plaintiff in this case. And that's why we cited the Woodward case, because that's exactly what they talk about. They say if there's a known right that you egregiously violated, corporations can be held responsible. And that's what we're seeking in form of our relief, is to hold Allstate responsible for their role in conspiring to essentially frame this plaintiff because she pursued an insurance claim with them. We're seeking a reversal of the district court's ruling pursuant to the written relief that we've requested, along with the relief requested under Rule 36. Thank you.
Okay. This case will be taken under advisement.